Good morning, everyone. We will be hearing just one case today, and that is In Re Amyristalc America, numbers 20-3485, 3486, 3487, and 3488. Counsel, as is your comfort level, you can remove masks at the table or certainly in speaking to us from the podium. And we will begin with Mr. Medlitsky.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve five minutes, if I could.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Anton Medlitsky for the appellant insurers. Much like a guardian ad litem, a future claimant's representative under Section 524G is tasked with representing future claimants who can't represent themselves, but who will be bound by the terms of the trust created by whatever plan the bankruptcy court confirms.
Mr. Medlitsky, you spend the first 10 pages of your brief urging that the role of the FCR is to root out fraud and prevent mismanagement from exhausting the trust funds. So to the extent that the trust funds are maximized and not spent and mismanaged and there's not fraud, it reduces the amount that would come from the excess insurers, would it not?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think fraudulent claims would be filed against the insurers by current
but
claimants.
But if the FCR roots out fraud and prevents all that money from being spent on fraudulent claims, that's to your benefit, is it not?
If the FCR roots out fraud, that would be good. That's true. But the conflict in this case is the fact that the FCR and his law firm are representing my clients at the same time as they're representing future claimants.
Well, and didn't you know that? I mean, in Wheeling Pumps, both Mr. Schiavone on behalf of O'Melveny and also Young Conaway entered appearances in 2010 in that case. And in fact, appeared together before the Supreme Court and the Superior Court, arguing both on behalf of excess insurers in 2015 and 2018. And at the April 26 hearing, Mr. Schiavone questioned Mr. Patton about this. It seems to me your clients made a conscious decision not to object based on disqualification, because you knew full well that Young Conaway represented excess insurers, and you were right alongside them all the way in the Wheeling Pumps case.
I don't think so, Your Honor. We were relying on the disclosure, which was inaccurate. The disclosure that Young Conaway gave said that it represented some of my clients with respect to
them. Surely you on notice. I mean, we've got these cases where you're there, you're standing right beside them.
Well, Your Honor, look, as a matter of fact, we did not know until we found out based on supplemental disclosures. But in any event, this is a waiver question, right? This is a waiver question.
This is a question of forfeiture. This is a question of whether you knew the facts that would give rise to disqualification for 2 months. And when you raised an objection, Mr. Schiavone himself, and he's the one who conducted the hearing, questioned Mr. Patton for 44 pages, basically.
Right.
Why shouldn't we say you consciously waived it or forfeited it by not raising it?
Because that was a question for the bankruptcy court to decide, and the bankruptcy court decided it. The bankruptcy court recognized that it had not asked for supplemental disclosures, but then it said that nonetheless, because the supplemental declaration, that is Mr. Patton's, contained further disclosures on the debtor's motion, I will address the new filing. Now, if they had an argument that was an abuse of discretion for some reason, they could have made it. But, for example, if there was some claim processing rule, let's say, that prevented the filing after the...
I believe were not on notice of this, because basically Mr. Schiavone's questioning shows he knew that Young Conaway had represented National.
Again, Your Honor, we weren't on notice from the disclosure, but our submission to the court is, our main submission to the court is, it was the bankruptcy court's decision whether it was going to allow an objection after its own internal claims management deadline. And unless that was an abuse of discretion, that's the opinion that this court is reviewing. It's reviewing the district court's decision only de novo, right? It's reviewing the bankruptcy court's decision for abuse of discretion.
Well, speaking of the bankruptcy court's obligation, why wouldn't there be waiver here based upon the waivers given by the excess insurers here. It's up to the bankruptcy court to look at this and assess it, and it did.
Right. So, I mean, a few reasons. First of all, we think the proper standard that should be applied to an FCR is something like a guardian ad litem standard, a fiduciary standard, where the FCR owes a duty of undivided loyalty.
And the bankruptcy court found that that was fulfilled here.
Right. The bankruptcy court, we think, applied the proper legal standard. We think it applied it incorrectly. First, because we don't think the waiver applies by its terms. But second, because we don't think this is the kind of conflict that can be waived for two basic reasons. First of all, if you look at, for example, 327A of the bankruptcy code, which applies to professionals like hired by the trustee, like an accountant or something like that. This court held in Congolium that kind of conflict, an actual conflict, couldn't be waived. And second of all, under Rule 1.7 itself, the only time you can have a waiver, the only way a client's waiver can be effective, is if both sides waive. And that's obviously not possible in this kind of situation when you have an FCR. That's, I'm citing 1.7b4. And so we think just as a matter of law, this kind of conflict waiver doesn't apply. It doesn't cure the problem of a disloyal fiduciary.
The bankruptcy court found it wasn't an actual conflict. Are you arguing that it's an appearance of conflict problem, or that the bankruptcy court got it wrong?
No, it's definitely that. To the extent that the bankruptcy court found it wasn't an actual conflict for any reason other than the waiver, that's definitely wrong, because the young Conway was representing my clients in Warren Pumps. And it's adverse to my client. The FCR is adverse to my clients in this case. The district court relied on this ABA opinion, which has to do with a totally different circumstance, where if I'm representing an insurer and a different client comes to me and says, can you represent me in suing Company X? And Company X has a policy written by the same insurer. That's not a direct conflict, even though the insurer would rather Company X win so they don't have to indemnify them.
But it's applicable
for the liability.
It makes a distinction between economic adversity and actual adversity.
But this is actual adversity. The FCR is actually adverse to the insurance companies in this case. The FCR hired...
How so?
So the FCR... Well, because the insurance companies, according to the plan that the FCR negotiated, are going to be transferred to the trust. And so the FCR is going to be going after the insurance policies directly, not indirectly.
Really? The trustees, the top trustees have the power to sue the insurance companies.
Well,
that's
yes, but
clear
the,
under the trust.
Well, the FCR has the power to help negotiate the plan, and it has the power to make coverage arguments, which they are already made. I mean, they hired
but
special
not,
insurance.
They don't have
counsel.
The power to sue. Does the FCR have the power to sue?
Well, the FCR probably. I don't see why the FCR couldn't bring an adversary proceeding in bankruptcy, just like any other creditor's representative.
It's not a party. The debtor is the debtor has the relationship with the insurers, does it not?
Well. The debtor, well, that's a disputed question, actually, in this bankruptcy, because the Imerys is not actually the insured. The argument is that the policies were transferred to Imerys,
without that ability, without that direct conflict that you had in Congolium and Pittsburgh Corning, it really is an economic adversity, is it not?
No, this is direct adversity. Again, they hired insurance counsel, special insurance counsel. The FCR did. They hired the Gilbert firm. They deposed the insurers in this case. They opposed our motion to lift the stay on the ongoing California coverage action because they want, I guess, the coverage questions in this case decided in this bankruptcy. They negotiated a plan that's going to transfer our policies.
They're looking, but as you point out, their main objective is to preserve whatever comes in, whatever the debtors and the top trustees are successful in obtaining, it's to preserve for the future claimants.
Exactly.
So they'll take the benefit of whatever insurance proceeds are brought in by the debtor or the top trustee. Let me ask you something else. The cases that you rely on where there's disqualification, there's a lot of detail about what counsel actually did in the proceedings that presents a conflict. And they did this X, Y, Z. We have nothing about what counsel did in Warren Pumps. We have Mr. Moose's declaration of right. Certain things that are similar, but we have no affidavit from anyone from the XX insurers saying these are the things they specifically did for us that give rise to the disqualification. This is the instance in which they gained strategy, et cetera, et cetera. We have nothing. We have an objection that is pretty much all over the lot but doesn't give us any information. Okay, what is it that they did that gives rise to the disqualification?
Well, so first of all, you don't need any of that kind of detail under 1.7a. So, for example, in Congolium and Pittsburgh Corning and the like, you don't have that.
Well,
it's just direct
adversity.
Well, I'm
talking about the ABA. I'm talking about information that would give the bankruptcy court the ability to kind of have an aha moment of saying, oh, well, we can't let this happen because X. And as the bankruptcy court said, the objection is, a lot of it's largely irrelevant.
Well, it's not irrelevant in the sense that if you think that the FCR has to have a duty of undivided loyalty like a lawyer would, then, and the FCR is in fact a lawyer, Rule 1.7 applies, and Rule 1.7a1 just doesn't require any details so long as there's actually actual adversity.
Does it apply if he's not acting in his capacity as a lawyer?
Well, Young Conway is acting as its capacity as a lawyer, and we've cited cases in...
But you're not challenging here Young Conway, you're challenging Mr. Patton himself.
Well, we are challenging Young Conway. I mean, in the first sentence of our objection, this is JA 939, we objected to, quote, Mr. Patton and Young Conway. But separate from that, if you look at the cases cited in footnote 14 of our reply brief, states routinely apply Rule 1.7 to guardians ad litem because, after all, they are lawyers. And even if you don't think that Rule 1.7 applies sort of directly, certainly the fiduciary standard would require a similar or, you know, a materially identical standard, if not a higher standard, for a fiduciary whose only job is to represent the interests of future claimants who aren't there. Like, imagine a class representative who's not a lawyer. Right. If a district court certified a class where the class representative was in any way adverse to absent class members, I assume that this court would reverse summarily because it would just be a per se violation.
Let's say that we are under 1.7a and that we believe that there is no direct adversity. Then shouldn't you have told us how there is a significant risk that the representation will be materially limited?
Well, I think we did tell you because they represented Warren Pumps in issues that are almost identically the same, if not identical. So let me just give you one example.
Who's saying that? We have some briefs, but we have nothing.
No, Mr. Muth said that. He said that there, as here, more than one corporate entity asserts a claim to insurance policy proceeds.
Okay.
So that issue is central.
Okay, there's an issue. Insurers have contribution rights. Okay. There are issues raised regarding whether excess policies owe defense obligations.
Right.
Does that tell us about how Young Conway, there were, what, 40 excess insurers in that company?
Young Conway was involved in the defense.
We don't know, presumably. We can't presume.
Well, I think you can infer that the lawyer spoke to their client about the issues that were before the court.
Maybe
confidential information.
What other lawyers were doing. We don't have anything to go on.
But all of that would be, I mean, I don't think we have the obligation to provide disclosed information.
What were they involved in specifically in that case? To say there are issues doesn't tell us. There are no cases where it says there's an issue. It says they did X on behalf of this client, therefore they can't do Y.
Well, again, Your Honor, we think there's an actual conflict pretty clearly. But even if you don't, I think you can impute that a lawyer works on an issue for their client and learns confidential information, learns the client's views about the merits and demerits of the argument, and they can use that information against the client.
In a lot of bankruptcy cases where there were 20 lawyers, a lot of time all you did was report what everybody else did. You really didn't get involved.
This was a coverage case.
Then why isn't the court below's Chinese wall of separation between the parties not enough? I presume your answer is because this is a fiduciary and fiduciaries held a higher standard. You keep switching back and forth between two ways of looking at the optical illusion. You say, oh, my clients are prejudiced. But if we don't buy that your clients are prejudiced here and they were sophisticated parties who chose to waive it, you then turn to the interests of the future claimants.
Right.
But it tells us a lot that the future claims representative is on the other side, that the trustee hasn't filed anything, and that the bankruptcy court, which is in the best and most objective position to assess who's being hurt, is not complaining here. So, it rings a little hollow to hear that your sophisticated clients are actually the ones who are looking out for the interest of their adversaries.
Well, so, Your Honor, I don't think that's the right way of looking at it. The conflict directly affects us because it's, after all, my client's lawyer that's now adverse to them. But we are raising legal arguments that are legal doctrines that are developed in part to protect absent parties. But that's exactly the same thing that happens in class certification cases. A defendant will come in and say, Judge, you can't certify this class because the plaintiff doesn't satisfy the typicality or adequacy of representation requirements in Rule 23A. Those requirements are there to protect absent class members, especially the adequacy requirement. The whole point is, if the plaintiff is inadequate, he's going to bind absent class members, and they're going to be collaterally stopped from suing the defendant. If that happens, I'm sure the defendant will be very happy. But I don't know anybody that has ever said that the defendant can't raise a Rule 23A objection based on a rule that was designed to protect absent class members, because the district court has a responsibility to make sure that absent class members are protected, and the defendant is the only one to raise those arguments. Obviously,
there are objectors, there are other people out there, and the defendant also has an interest in making sure that the ruling in that case is, in fact, going to grant the defendant complete relief in the case, right? That's not an issue here. So why shouldn't we trust the bankruptcy court, which is closest to the facts, as long as it's applying the correct legal standard, to weigh whether, in fact, the class members, future class representatives are being adequately taken care of?
Well, for two reasons. I mean, first of all, I think any abuse of discretion standard is channeled by law. And if you think a fiduciary standard applies, then it would be an abuse of discretion to appoint an FCR that doesn't comply with a standard duty of complete loyalty. But second of all, I'm not sure it's true that our client would have respite no matter what. Because if a future claimant shows up 20 years from now and says, it turns out I was represented by a conflicted fiduciary, and now there's no money left in this trust because and this guy wasn't looking out for my best interests, I'm not sure that there wouldn't be a due process right to collaterally attack the trust. That's the whole reason why.
Why isn't this an issue of standing? I mean, certainly you could raise for the bankruptcy court to consider, a conflict or potential conflict as an ethical matter, and that's something that the court could take up.
Right.
But now we're talking about the jurisprudential limitations on appellate standing.
Yeah.
And why, I mean, the argument you're making now seems like, we're back in the realm of federal insurance v. Grace, with sort of four times remoteness, where we're considering the traveler standard, mm-hmm. and all of the things that would have to happen for that to come about. Why is your client the right person to raise the purely fiduciary concern, putting aside the waiver issue?
So I think those things are tied together,
Let's just step back on that for a second, because mm-hmm. Do I understand correctly that only two of your clients that you represent were actually involved in Warren Pumps and signed waivers?
That's right.
So the others, their standing is based entirely on their purported representation of the interests of future claimants.
Well, I think there are two arguments on standing. One is just Congolium says that insurers or really anybody have standing to raise an ethical conflict because nobody, especially insurers and especially in a bankruptcy, because nobody else would raise them up. The debtor's not going to raise them. The current claimants aren't going to raise them. They all negotiated the plan.
But there it was a special agent who was under consideration. Here, the trustee is in a position to raise issues about the FCR, and in fact, made some noises about that before the bankruptcy court.
Right.
And there are the two others who, because they also have the prospective waiver issue, have unquestionably have standing. So why do the remaining insurers have standing?
So long as the two that were the clients of Young Conway have standing, which I think is, they have to have standing, as long as one party has standing, they're standing to resolve the issue. So I'm not sure why the other insurers would have to have standing. But I think the answer is Congolium. Anybody has standing.
Well, in part because when we are making decisions about the resolution of a case, we're thinking about both this case and how those principles might apply going forward.
Sure.
So are you conceding that those who did not sign prospective waivers lack standing to proceed solely on the basis of concerns about conflicts for future claimants?
Definitely not. We're not conceding that because we think that's the square holding of Congolium. But in this case, there's standing no matter what, because obviously any of my clients are adverse to their own lawyer, they have standing.
But Congolium put some limits on that, including where there might be an interest on the part of someone else to bring to raise the objection.
Right.
Why isn't that true for the trustee when it comes to this sort of conflict or potential conflict for an FCR?
Well, the U.S. trustee did raise an objection before the before all the disclosures.
Doesn't that just drive the point home that there is someone else to raise that objection, and that was one of the considerations in Congolium?
But I believe there was a trustee in Congolium too. I mean, the point of that, I think the point of that case was that anybody has not just the right but a duty to raise an ethical conflict. It's true that the court noticed that insurers were in a particularly good position to do so because other parties to the bankruptcy wouldn't. And I think that's true here, but I don't think that was necessary for the decision. I think just as a general rule of law, everybody has an interest in an unconflicted process, because a conflict of interest is just the malignancy on the process generally, and that's especially true in bankruptcy. And I would hope this court doesn't retreat from that general holding of Congolium. But in this case, I don't think there's any possible argument that at least two of my clients have standing. And so I think the court has an obligation to resolve the issue. I'm not even sure I understand the standing argument.
What do you think happens here if we were to accept your argument as to Patton, number one, and Young Conaway, number two?
I think the bankruptcy court would have to replace them and appoint a new FCR.
And what would that do to the proceeding?
I mean, that kind of thing happens all the time. I think the new FCR would presumably look back and see if he thinks anything needs to be redone. But as a general matter, the proceeding would
just continue.
Would continue. I mean, that happens.
What is left to do in the case?
Well, there haven't even been objections filed to the plan yet. So there's.
All right. But all the litigation is over, is it not, with the insurers?
We don't know.
Final judgment has been entered.
Oh, you mean in Warren Pumps?
I mean Warren Pumps, yes. Oh,
sorry. Final judgment has been entered. There may be, I don't know if there are going to be contribution actions or anything like that, but final judgment as to Warren Pumps has been entered. Yeah. But in this case, there's certainly more to do.
Yeah, okay. I thought confirmation was scheduled. It's scheduled for the fall?
The hearing is currently scheduled for the fall, and I think objections are due to be filed sometime in October.
All right, so.
Counsel, we've let you go well over time, and I'm sure our clerk has been keeping track of it. Why don't we just add on, and we've already gone some into it, 10 minutes, and let us know when we've reached the end of that, from the end of where we were at the red light.
Thank you, Ron.
Why don't you add 5 minutes from now if you don't have time? To appellant's time. I think we still have some additional questions for you.
I'm sorry. Okay. Sure.
So I'd like to get your thoughts on the appointment process, and with concern for future prepackaged bankruptcies. And if there is a standard that precludes a prior relationship with a debtor, what effect that would have on the ability to move forward efficiently with a prepackaged bankruptcy?
A prior relationship with the debtor?
Pre-petition. The pre-petition engagement here?
Yeah, so, oh, well, so.
Is that the question?
Is that the question? So the prior relationship is with the insurers in this case. And it's not a prior relationship, it's a current conflict.
But your initial objection in the case had to do with the fact that there was pre-petition,
confidential pre-petition
engagement.
The debtor, right. I mean, so I think that the debtor needs to find an unconflicted FCR. And certainly the bankruptcy court shouldn't be able to appoint a conflicted FCR. I mean, they didn't disclose the fact that they were hired by the debtor pre-petition here.
But you raise, and let me make sure I understand, it's not an independent objection on your part then that the FCR that was put forward had that prior relationship and was working with the debtor pre-petition?
No, the objection is that when they were, the FCR, even pre-petition, post-petition, was representing two of my clients. And that should never have happened. If that had been disclosed, we would have objected. But they didn't disclose the conflict pre-petition. Obviously, they eventually disclosed it post-petition, and we objected.
But they did disclose that they represented National Union, did they not?
Pre-petition?
Yes. In his declaration, Mr. Patton and...
In Warren Pumps? I don't think so.
No, in this case,
they said Young Conaway represents National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, et cetera, et cetera, in insurance coverage disputes that relate to environmental liabilities, including asbestos claims unrelated to TAP claims.
Right, so I believe that was post-petition once he was put up for to be appointed by...
No, this was in his application, in his initial filing.
Right, and we think that...
February 27th.
Right, so there's a dispute about whether that...
A notice?
Yes, because the Warren Pump had nothing to do with environmental liabilities. Environmental liabilities, including asbestos claims, is like a circle of claim where there's asbestos in the buildings.
Don't you think when it says National Union, the beaver should go off and you call National Union and say, yo, where did Young Conaway represent you? Wouldn't that be logical?
Your Honor, I think that the burden is on them to have an accurate disclosure. But in any event, this was a question for the bankruptcy court. If the bankruptcy court decided that it didn't want to hear an objection in May, it could have decided that. But instead, it decided to hear the objection. So, I'm not sure what else to...
But the district court found forfeiture based upon the fact that you didn't...
Right, but the district court... The only way the district court could have found forfeiture when the bankruptcy court didn't is if the bankruptcy court had abused its discretion by extending its own internal deadline, its case management deadline.
No, there wasn't some... The district court could have an additional reason, and it wasn't additional...
But the district court's only reason was that we waited too long to raise the objection, and the bankruptcy court rejected that argument. If there were some legal rule that, let's say a claims processing rule, that so long as the other side raises it, precludes a court from allowing an untimely filing, then I would understand what we were talking about when the bankruptcy court said that we waived the objection. But there is no such rule. This was just an internal case management deadline. The district court has plenary discretion over those kinds of things. So I don't think the bankruptcy court had the authority to decide the district court had authority to decide that the bankruptcy court had abused its discretion by extending that deadline.
Can I go back to the process for a second? Because in looking at what various courts have done in the past, some, as in UNR, have taken the position that it's initially the province of the trustee to put forward a proposed FCR, that they have first dibs at it, and then others can make their proposals. Others have left it open, where the debtor makes the proposal in the first instance.
Right.
What is your position as to what the proper process is under 524?
So I'm not sure that question goes directly to our objection in this case, but I think we probably agree with the U.S. trustee that other candidates should be considered. That was the U.S. trustee's position in this case, and it's been the U.S. trustee's position for a while. It seems very strange that the debtor would be the only one that puts up a candidate. But in all circumstances, no matter who puts up the candidate, the bankruptcy court, in our view, abuses its discretion by choosing a candidate who's conflicted. After all, there are plenty of people that aren't conflicted. So the bankruptcy court should choose one of them.
The trustee in this case actually put forward any candidate?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. One other point on you mentioned UNR. And I think the other side relies on UNR for the standard, and I think actually the right model is Johns Manville, because in that case the proto FCR, the legal representative, was actually meant to bind future claimants, and there Judge Liflin explained that the only reason why that was allowed is because the legal representative was akin to a trustee or a guardian ad litem acting as a fiduciary for their interests. In UNR, my friends on the other side cite an opinion earlier in the process saying that rejecting a guardian ad litem standard. But with respect, I think that's fairly misleading, because that opinion was written by the district court about 3 years before a legal representative was appointed, 2 or 3 years. And it rejected the appointment of any legal representative. It just thought it didn't have the ability to do that. And so when it said, I also don't have the ability to appoint a guardian ad litem, that doesn't really tell you anything, because, again, it rejected any kind of appointment. After some tortured procedural history a few years later, the district court seemed to change its mind, sent it back down to the bankruptcy court. at which point the bankruptcy court said it would appoint a legal representative, but that legal representative was very different than the one in Johns Manville and then the one that was eventually adopted by Congress, because it seemed that the bankruptcy judge in UNR expected that the future claimants would actually show up at some point, and then they would be treated as ordinary creditors. And so the court held that the primary task of this legal representative, that I'm quoting, will be to advise putative asbestos disease victims of the pendency of and their interest in these proceedings. So I don't think UNR was conceiving them of somebody who would actually bind, conceiving of the legal representative, which is why it's totally unclear from the opinion what standard the court thought would apply. At some point he calls it an amicus curiae. At some point he uses the word disinterested. The other side thinks he's invoking the definition from the bankruptcy code. I'm not sure that's true, but at other points he says the legal representative will have the powers of a creditors committee under 1103, and of course under 1103B, a creditors committee representative can't be conflicted. So I'm not sure there's much to get from that case.
We'll hear back from you on rebuttal, Mr. Milinski.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And why don't we add 10 minutes? Thanks.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Ramon Martinez. I represent Imerys, and my colleague, Mr. Heron, is here representing Mr. Patton. Your Honor, there's a lot going on and a lot of great questions in this appeal. I just wanted to start perhaps by directly addressing Your Honor's question about the practical consequences of actually disqualifying Patton, because I think it's very important. It provides the context for this decision. If this appeal succeeds, the result is going to be to upend a bankruptcy proceeding that's finally coming to the finish line after 2.5 years of very intense work. A new FCR, as my friend Mr. Milinski agreed, would need to be selected and approved. This wouldn't necessarily be easy because, as Your Honors were just discovering, no other FCR was proposed in the first place. So that would take some time. It would be vetted, approved. Once the new FCR comes into office, that FCR, to do his job or her job, would need to conduct a very thorough due diligence into all of the issues that have come up in the bankruptcy. This would take a lot of time, and it would take a lot of expense. In addition, you know, the purpose of the FCR is to actually play a meaningful role in all of the discussions, all of the negotiations. We now have a plan of reorganization that is before the bankruptcy court for approval. That FCR would need to re-examine that plan of reorganization and decide whether to renegotiate one aspect of it, two aspects of it, the entire thing, potentially.
That may be true, but there are principles at play here. Disqualification and conflicts are taken very seriously, especially in the context of the bankruptcy. Your opponent says, well, you know, Patton and Young Conaway, they're deposing excess insurers. Aren't they adverse, and shouldn't this be the touchstone, not the consequences, as difficult as they may be?
So I think there are a couple different points there, and I think the three most important things, just to tick them off, number one, there was a clear forfeiture here. They didn't raise this objection on time. Number two, the engagement letter unambiguously waived the conflict, and it was geared towards exactly this kind of proceeding. And number three, with respect to the argument that the insurers are the ones who should be able to defend the rights of the future claimants, that is a novel argument. It's never been accepted before, and for good reason. And so
Congolium standing is very broad, and anybody can bring this to the attention of the court. The fact that, you know, it seems highly unusual that they're doing this, nonetheless, Congolium's language is pretty strong that, you know, we're happy to have these things brought to the attention of the courts.
I think that's fair, although I do think that Congolium didn't disown the aggrieved person standard. I think what it said in that case was that the conflict was such, you know, that case, of course, involved someone who is super conflicted because he was representing two different parties in the bankruptcy itself. There's nothing like that here. But I think Congolium sort of maybe stretched the concept of aggrieved person. I think this case would require you to really extend Congolium because of the fact that the conflict here, their entire theory of the conflict that the insurers are raising is that Mr. Patton is not going to be able to represent the future claimants because he's going to be too favorable to us, to the insurers. He's not going to do a good job of taking all of our money and giving it to the future claimants. I mean, that is an argument that doesn't make a lot of sense and doesn't really pass the straight face test.
Maybe they're saying that Young Conaway got privileged or confidential information. I mean, I'm not 100% sure what they're saying, but if that's it,
Well, that's their argument based on their own conflict, which they waived. Their argument based on the future claimants, even if it were true that they got some sort of privileged information, which we don't know anything about, as Your Honor pointed out, but there's no record on this. But even if that were true, that would actually help the future claimants in theory. And so their theory is it wouldn't hurt them. And so with respect to their theory that the insurers need to be the ones to stand, you know, athwart the barricade and defend the rights of the future claimants, because otherwise, you know, the Mr. Patton is going to be too favorable to them, to the insurers.
Why isn't the interest really defending the integrity of the bankruptcy process? Because fast forward, you know, a couple decades, and if someone's coming forward and successfully bringing a due process claim, that's really not in the interests of the parties or the institution of the bankruptcy court.
No, I think that's the point that's made. I guess a couple things. First of all, you have a bankruptcy judge who is ideally positioned to defend the integrity of the process. And then that bankruptcy judge is going to be backstopped by the U.S. trustee. There was discussion about the objection that the U.S. trustee made. I think it's notable that the U.S. trustee then acceded. The objections that were made have nothing to do with what's at issue here. And the U.S. trustee is not here advancing the same argument that the insurers are arguing about the, you know, this potential conflict involving the future claimants. I also think it's really important to look at the nature of the asserted conflict here, and just let's put ourselves in the shoes of the future claimants. You know, the Fairbanks opinion, which we disagree with because we don't think the guardian ad litem standum applies, but I think it actually has a very helpful formulation of how to think about these issues. It basically says the bankruptcy court needs to figure out, is this the kind of person that the future claimants themselves, if they were here, would want to appoint to represent their interests? So it's a kind of practical analysis. And here, look at the conflict that's being asserted here. We're talking about the Warren Pumps case. All of the substantive issues in the Warren Pumps case were resolved in the trial court, the Delaware trial court, in 2014. They were resolved by the Delaware Supreme Court in 2016, years before Patton came into the picture. If you look at the billing records from Young Conaway, from 2017 until the present day, it is cited in a footnote in their brief, a grand total of $17,000 were spent on Young Conaway in the Warren Pumps litigation. In addition to that, we have uncontroverted evidence in the record that neither Mr. Patton nor his team from Young Conaway that's working on this case had anything to do with the Warren Pumps case. And on top of that, you've got an ethical wall. This is exactly the kind of maybe, even if it's an arguably a technical conflict here, it's exactly the kind of conflict that's irrelevant and that in the real world, real life clients are not going to care about this. And so if we step back and we think the purpose of this whole inquiry is, let's figure out what's best for the future claimants would not be bothered by this conflict. Now,
but say we're thinking about a heightened standard, call it guardian ad litem or something akin sure. to it. Does that necessarily include an appearance of conflict standard as well? And if so, how would that apply in a situation like this?
Well, look, we think as a formal matter, the guardian ad litem standard doesn't sort of technically apply. Frankly, just to be clear, I do think that the labels are are less important. What really matters is the question of, is there a categorical disqualification rule or not? And even in the guardian ad litem context, different states have different rules that govern that question. My friend on the other side points to New York, which according to the cases he cites, say that you know, a court can't waive a conflict in appointing a guardian ad litem. But if you look at Virginia, the Virginia legal ethics opinion, I think it's 1725, actually says that, you know, in a circumstance in which the proposed guardian ad litem might have a conflict, the court should be the one who should look at it and figure things out. And we think that's the more common sense approach, especially when you're dealing with such a technical and irrelevant conflict as the one that's asserted here.
But is that to say that that a court, we should not weigh in on what the standard is and just leave that to bankruptcy courts to deal with in their discretion?
So I think that I think you have a couple options, Your Honor. I think the most straightforward way to resolve this case is on the forfeiture ground, which would allow you to leave that to the side. And I think there are ways you can resolve it even if you get to the merits without setting out the standard. If you want to say something about the standard, I would just respectfully suggest three principles that you announce and I think would give a lot of guidance. I think the first principle would be that when appointing an FCR, the bankruptcy court should look for someone who is competent, independent, diligent, hardworking, able to do the job. I think that's pretty straightforward. I think both sides would probably agree to that. The second principle would be to say that conflicts need to be looked at very closely, but you need to preserve the safety valve that Rule 1.7 itself creates. And that safety valve allows for waivers. And the reason the safety valve is there in 1.7 is because there are a large number of conflicts that are technical conflicts that really don't have any bearing on a case and in the real world aren't going to make a difference. And Rule 1.7 recognizes that although we have a broad rule against conflicts, we're going to have the safety valve so that a client can waive. Now, in the future claimant situation, it's a hard because the future claimants aren't there. And so in this particular context, you can carry over the Rule 1.7 safety valve principle, but say that the bankruptcy court should be the one to make the determination. That's kind of like what Virginia does in the guardian ad litem context. That's kind of like how district courts operate in the context of class actions. So that's my second principle is, you know, look at conflicts very carefully and take them very seriously, but also allow for a safety valve. And then the third principle is just reaffirming the importance of the bankruptcy court in this process. The bankruptcy court is closest to the action, sees the evidence, knows the bankruptcy law and the kind of issues that the FCR is going to need to deal with, and is ideally positioned to make the ultimate judgment about whether the FCR should be appointed. I think those three principles, it's not a hard and fast rule, but I think that would provide a lot of guidance to bankruptcy courts facing these decisions going forward.
That third one just begged the question. You want us to defer to bankruptcy courts, but how does that give guidance to bankruptcy courts? Like, whatever you do, we're going to affirm it? I mean, there have to be some limits here. What's the relevance of, you know, the sophistication of the parties? What's the relevance of the number of alternative people who have this expertise? I mean, it does seem, you know, you and your friends on the other side have a disagreement here about how important was it to appoint, you know, Patton and young Conway here.
Well, I think, Your Honor, I think those are absolutely valid considerations, and I think they would play into the first two principles that I laid out. I like hard and fast rules, and this is not a hard and fast rule, but I think this does kind of would channel the discretion of the bankruptcy courts in a way that would be helpful and would clear up some of the confusion. I do think, just to address your specific points, I think that when a bankruptcy court is, for example, assessing a waiver question, it's perfectly appropriate for it to consider the sophistication of the parties. If the bankruptcy court is trying to figure out whether to take out, you know, take Mr. Patton, who is sort of recognized as the preeminent FCR in the country, and take him off the field entirely, I think the bankruptcy court should reasonably consider what the alternatives are.
But how about the sophistication? I mean, under 1.7, even the waiver requires consent of the other party. How about the sophistication of the future claimants? Is it up to Patton to say, oh, this is just fine, or they're an unrepresented party at the table? How do we say that waiver's all right?
I would not say that in deciding whether to appoint Patton, he should be the one to say that, you know, he waives the conflict as to himself. I think that the more straightforward and commonsensical approach is to say that in those circumstances, we got to trust the bankruptcy judge, because the bankruptcy judge is independent. It's in the middle of the process. It can ask Patton all the questions it wants. It can ask the parties the questions they want, and it can make a reasonable judgment on behalf of the future claimants.
Let's go back to the criteria we identify in that first factor that you laid out. I mean, competence and diligence sounds a lot like the standard of disinterestedness. What about loyalty? What about fiduciary duty? What about independence from other parties?
If I didn't mention those, I think those are in there as well. I think loyalty and independence are important. I think the one sort of, and that starts to sound a little bit more like some of the considerations that we hear in the Guardian ad litem case law. I want to be very clear. If there were a situation, just a hypothetical situation, where a proposed FCR was coming up and he sort of satisfied the technical disinterestedness standard, but the bankruptcy court concluded that he was not going to be loyal and he was not going to be independent, of course that person should not be appointed. So those are absolutely valid considerations to play into this. I think where we need to be a little careful, though, is in saying, okay, well, we're going to borrow this guardian ad litem concept that doesn't directly apply, that the code doesn't require. And then not only are we going to sort of borrow those adjectives, but we're also going to borrow a bunch of case law from the state of New York that then says, and this means there's a categorical disqualification rule and a court can't overlook that. I think that's the real problem. And that's why I think the labels don't matter as much as the principles. And although I think loyalty and independence are extremely important, and a bankruptcy court does need to be a hawk and look out for conflicts, I think a bankruptcy court also needs to be able to exercise common sense. And when confronted with the kind of technical but irrelevant conflict at issue here, needs to be able to say, come on, a client would waive this conflict because Warren Pumps is essentially over. Young Conaway's participation is minimal, and the people who are going to be involved here don't have anything to do with their representation at Warm Pumps. That's just a common sense solution to what is otherwise a somewhat tricky theoretical problem.
So put the label aside. Is there any reason why the standard here should be any different than that for a creditors committee, for example, and members of a creditors committee who also have fiduciary duties, right?
Your Honor, I would just resist the urge to just sort of import wholesale a different standard, because I think that there may be unintended consequences that come along with doing that. It seems to me that the code...
Is there really a different standard, though? I mean, we're thinking about the standard for the legal representative of a future claimant. Why shouldn't we look to what the bankruptcy code and the case law have already developed when it comes to the legal representative of current claimants?
Right. Well, I think that if you're going to do that, I think the best place to look would be at the disinterestedness standard that applies to the appointment of the trustee. And so we think if you're going to borrow, that's the most sort of logical place to go.
But the trustee doesn't represent a group of claimants per se, right? Its loyalties are to the entire estate, and including looking to the debtor and the fairness and equity of the
right. And Mr. Patton is not representing; he's not serving as a lawyer, but he's standing in the shoes essentially as the alter ego. And so I think the trustee is essentially the alter ego of the estate. Patton is the alter ego of a certain set of future claimants.
So why isn't the best analogy to the legal representative of a group of current claimants?
You mean like their lawyers? Like the
creditors committee.
Yeah. I think that to the extent that imports in the 327 and a categorical disqualification rule, I think that it would lead to bad results for future claimants. And just stepping back again, if we look at the question the way that the Fairbanks Court posed it, is we need to pick a standard here and have an approach that is going to essentially answer the question of who would the future claimants want to hire. I think if you import a categorical disqualification rule from Section 327, which on its face, of course, doesn't apply here, what you're going to end up doing is you're going to have way too many disqualifications, and that's going to lower the quality of the FCRs generally. Let me just illustrate this in this case. Their categorical disqualification rule would mean that any person who is at a law firm of any of the insurers, not just the two that are at issue here, but any of the insurers that were listed in the disclosures, there are 111 different insurers that are listed in Patton's disclosures, that anyone in any law firm associated with that, those are insurance, all those insurance companies, any law firm that ever represented those insurance companies in a coverage dispute, completely off the table. Now, maybe we could think, okay, we can just pick a hypothetical FCR from some other place, but that place doesn't always exist. And I think the Fairbanks Court really gave a very clear and helpful explanation of why, in that case, Patton was the best of the four people who had been put forward, but why, in general, it's really important to have knowledgeable, expert FCRs. And I think if you go to a rule that is going to make it harder for future claimants to get that kind of expertise, it's just going to hurt their interest in the long run. And there's nothing in the bankruptcy code that requires that result. And there's nothing in common sense that requires that result. We should treat the representative of the future claimants and think about the conflicts and waiver questions in the same way that we would think about them if we were the future claimants. And I think in a circumstance like this, where the alleged conflict is very technical and very irrelevant, we would not think that this is a problem in real life. And if that's true for us, we shouldn't make it impossible for the future claimants to be represented by someone of Mr. Patton's caliber and experience.
Can you talk some to the appointment process?
Sure.
How, from your perspective, that should work? Perhaps oddly, we don't have, even as amicus, the views of the trustee.
Your Honor,
that perspective as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, look, I just at a very general level, I think I agree with my friend that question is not really presented in the appeal, although obviously you all can say whatever you want about it. I do think that in general it seems to me that the bankruptcy code itself is pretty silent on exactly the process. It seems like there's no impediment in the bankruptcy code to allowing multiple individuals to come forward or be nominated by any party in interest. And I think that under the principles, the three principles that I set out earlier, I think it's at that point what a bankruptcy court could well do is solicit applications or suggestions and then look at who's on the table and then, you know, bring them in, ask them questions, look at their declarations, and then make exercise reasoned discretion. And so I don't think we have an objection to that. There's certainly nothing we've said in our briefs that would suggest that the debtors always need to be the only one who's allowed to nominate.
You when in referencing 1.7, you were talking about potential for waiver. Do you concede that 1.7 should apply to a lawyer who's acting in an FCR capacity?
I don't think so, Your Honor. There's nothing in the code that requires the FCR himself to be a lawyer. And if that's true, it seems odd that there would be some sort of formalistic rule that 1.7 would apply. I think, you know, it's also notable that that for purposes of, you know, 101.14, the definition of disinterestedness, it talks about having an interest. It doesn't talk about representing an interest. I think that sort of supports the idea that the FCR doesn't necessarily have to be a lawyer, that we're not sort of worried about applying the same conflict rules. That said, though, I don't want to make too much of this point, because I do think it's a fair consideration in all candor for a bankruptcy court to consider whether the person is a lawyer or not, whether Rule 1.7 technically applies or not. Of course it's appropriate for a bankruptcy court to consider if there's a real conflict and the bankruptcy court thinks this person might not be actually independent in real life, perfectly appropriate to consider that. We just think that in these particular circumstances, that's just not a concern, because this is such a fake conflict. Even if it's an actual conflict, which we don't think it is, but even if it were an actual conflict as a technical matter, it would be so small and irrelevant. And, of course, with respect to their own rights, it's been waived or forfeited.
It looks like some courts, in talking about, they label it the guardian ad litem standard, but this heightened standard, have distinguished that as an appearance of conflict or appearance of impropriety versus the actual conflict standard that would go along with disinterestedness. Do you agree that if we were to take the approach of a heightened standard, something akin to that involving a creditors committee, that it's the appearance of a conflict would be disqualifying?
I don't think you should apply a categorical rule. I don't think there's anything in the code that would prevent the bankruptcy court from considering whether there's an appearance of impropriety. So I'm not, but frankly, we haven't taken a position on that in the brief. I do think that the key principle that I think is extremely important is that there can't be a categorical disqualification rule at all here, but certainly not based on an appearance of impropriety. You know, as this court has said many times, if you have only a potential conflict or if you have an appearance of impropriety type concern, that's not a basis for automatic disqualification, and we do allow waivers. And so I think whatever you do, you should not import. The most important thing is not to import a categorical disqualification rule.
So say there's room for waivers, like the ABA ethics opinion. But even there, that opinion noted that a situation where counsel had to take discovery from their own clients may cross the line. Why don't we have that here?
Well, I think at the time of the appointment, you didn't have that here. So at most, it was a potential conflict. I think even that, what that opinion I think also says is that even in those circumstances, it's not an automatic conflict or an automatic disqualification rule, but rather a court needs to look at the nature of the discovery. And here, I don't think that the nature of that discovery has been entered into the record. But my understanding is that it was sort of basic information was being requested, and it wouldn't be the kind of thing that would trigger a conflict. But certainly at the time of the appointment, this would have been at most a potential conflict, which wouldn't have triggered any sort of categorical disqualification.
Do you agree that the fact that Warren Pumps is not ongoing, if there had been over the course of these past couple of years an actual conflict, that there may still be grounds for unwinding the appointment?
I don't think so, because I think that the waiver, if you're asking me to assume an actual conflict that was live for a number of years, I think the waiver clearly would have covered that, the express waiver in the engagement letter. You know, we reproduced the language at pages 40 to 41 of our brief. We think that language, you know, if it doesn't cover this case, it's hard to know what it covers. The express purpose of that language was just to cover the ability of Young Conaway to participate in 524G asbestos-related bankruptcy proceedings. Both parties knew this. They're sophisticated parties. The district court, I think, pointed this out, or the bankruptcy court pointed this out, pointed to the fact that that the insurers had previously participated in 524G cases. They knew what they were getting into when they signed up to that language. And they promised in that language not just to waive the conflict, but not to raise it as a basis for disqualification. And so I think that it would be, you know, really disrupt the kind of contractual relationship between the parties if you were to somehow, you know, look askance at that express waiver. And so we think that even if there were an actual conflict, it was waived by that letter.
I understand that argument, but putting that aside, does the fact that Warren Pumps is now closed as a matter, that would not remedy an actual conflict, if assuming there was one for these past
years? I think that's probably fair, because I think that the right point in time at which to analyze the question is at the point of appointment. I do think, though, that it should color your consideration of the case more generally as a practical matter. I think it confirms that really it's if anything, a technical but irrelevant conflict. And I also think it might inform your discretion when you're deciding whether to address the forfeiture argument, which we think is the most straightforward way to resolve this case. I think you have the discretion to address that forfeiture argument. And one factor that might play into that discretion is the fact that this Warren Pumps thing is over. It's not a real concern. Can I just make one last point on the forfeiture point? Because I think my friend on the other side indicated that his primary argument with respect to that is that neither you nor the district court have the authority to rule on the forfeiture argument because the bankruptcy court didn't rule on it. I just respectfully, to my friend, I would disagree with that, and that's inconsistent with how courts deal with these kinds of issues all the time. The Supreme Court just a year or two ago resolved a case, United States versus Sinang Smith, where they expressly said that an argument that had been that had been passed upon directly by the Ninth Circuit had been waived, and they decided that part of the case on waiver grounds. I myself was involved in a case in the Second Circuit, Biocad versus Hoffman LaRoche, about 2 years ago, in which Judge Sullivan, when he was on the district court, resolved an issue on the merits. We pointed out that it had been waived, and the Second Circuit agreed with us and said it was waived. It didn't address the issue on the merits. There's another example I can give you, I think, from the Eighth Circuit, United States versus Taylor. So courts regularly look at those issues. They do not apply an abusive discretion standard. They do not say that you know, the decision by a lower court to go on and reach a forfeited argument is subject to abusive discretion review, such that an appellate court reviewing that needs to conclude that there was an abusive discretion. You know, this argument about forfeiture was fully preserved in both courts below by our side. And so it's absolutely on the table, and it's a very clean way to resolve this case, although it may be that the panel wants to clarify the law more generally beyond the forfeiture issue here.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Herron?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Ed Herron on behalf of the future claimant's representative, who was also my law partner, James L. Patton, Jr. I get the sense that the court may have a few questions for me, but I would like to kind of sum up our position, if I may. Essentially, we believe that the insurers who signed Young Conaway's engagement letter have either forfeited or waived their right to bring this appeal. For those insurers who were not parties to the engagement letter, it's our view that they lack standing to pursue the issues that are before the court.
How do you say they lack standing, given Congolium's very broad sweep regarding people raising things, disqualifications?
Your Honor, I'm pleased you asked me that question. Congolium was based on very specific facts. And I think the heart of the court's concern in Congolium was issues unique to prepackaged bankruptcies. Congolium cites, I think repeatedly, to combustion engineering, which was really the first time the court considered 524G in the context of a prepackaged case. It noted the peculiarities of that process, the lack of transparency in that process, which weighed in favor of giving parties who maybe were unable to raise issues at the bankruptcy court level to still participate in the appellate process. We don't think that Congolium fits here. In fact, Congolium itself recognized that parties may use disqualification strategically. And we think that's what the insurers are doing.
Well, But what if there were a real record here as to all the things that young Conway did in Warren Pumps, and they seem to be directly opposed to what they'd have to be doing in representing the future claimants? You're saying that someone would raise that on appeal to us and argue it, and we would say, oh, too bad, no standing, you're out of here. Would a court really do that?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, we believe that if that record were fully disclosed, it would show that young Conway's role in Warren Pumps was very limited.
Well, that's the other thing. I'm wondering why that isn't before us. Any contention on your part? I mean, I assume you're going to say, well, the burden's on them to tell what the conflict is. But why wouldn't you at least assert that so that would put them to the test of saying, no, we don't agree?
Assert the nature of the representation?
Well, just assert that you didn't do, you know, they said confidential information, privileged information. Now, granted, it's a lawyer's argument. It's not, we don't have it at any actual affidavit. But I'm surprised there wouldn't be something from young Patton that would say we didn't, I mean, young Conway, that would say we didn't get confidential proprietary information, et cetera.
Well, Your Honor, we try to be very careful in responding to the insurer's allegations without actually disclosing the substantive nature of our work in Viking Pump, which we think would have fed into their accusations that our bankruptcy group was sharing information with the folks in the coverage group.
You could have characterized that would put them the burden of putting, you know, giving things in camera to the bankruptcy court, you know, confidentially.
We did note in our briefs the modest fees that were generated from that engagement. And we did note that to the extent there were coverage issues, those coverage issues were resolved in 2018, prior to Mr. Patton becoming involved in the Emmerich case. If you reviewed the Viking Pumps record, you would see that the only issue remaining in that case is the determination of statutory interest. So really, there are no coverage issues remaining by the time Mr. Patton became involved in this case. But young Conway had a very limited, if any, role in coverage issues. And to be clear, there are no coverage issues involved in the disputes regarding insurance in this case. My friend alluded to coverage disputes in the Emmerich case. Your Honor should be aware that the Emmerich case involves about 100 years of corporate history, over 100 insurance policies, over 100 insurers, over 700 insurer policies. The Emmerich talc mines were owned by different corporate entities over the course of time. The only issue that's live relating to insurance in the Emmerich case is whether the bundle of assets Emmerich acquired when it acquired the mines included the rights to the predecessor's insurance. There's no policy interpretation going on in the Emmerich bankruptcy case. In fact, I believe it was Judge Rendell who noted that the common practice and the practice that's embodied in the Emmerich plan here is for that insurance to be transferred to a trust in whatever form the debtor finds it. And it would be the trustee's role to pursue that insurance, not the role of the future claimant's rep.
Your client frequently plays the role of FCR. Will you address what the standard for an FCR should be? Between the polls of the courts that have talked about it as disinterested versus guardian ad litem, whatever that means in substance.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you for that question. And I would note you are correct. We've made a practice out of the future claimant's work in many of these cases. I would note for the record of the few cases with which we are not involved, those include combustion engineering and Congolium, which met with some disfavor at this court. But what should the standard be? I agree with the articulation of my friend, Mr. Martinez, of what an appropriate standard would be if this court decided that guidance was necessary for the bankruptcy court. Traditionally, it's been the disinterestedness standard, which we believe, and I believe Judge Silverstein found Mr. Patton would meet. And that the case law has recently evolved into a guardian ad litem standard, which Mr. Patton also met, according to Judge Silverstein. But we do agree with Mr. Martinez what an appropriate standard would be. Courts should understand whether there are any conflicting interests which may put the future rep's duty of loyalty at issue and make an evaluation of whether or not those those adverse interests are material or technical, as Mr. Martinez said. You should also understand the candidate's experience with bankruptcies, mass tort, insolvencies specifically, and the court should take a close look at whether or not the candidate was involved pre-petition. Of course, we don't view that factor as disqualifying. And again, we took guidance from Combustion Engineering, which actually criticized the parties for not involving a futures rep in the process early enough. But the court should consider, why was a futures rep involved in the case before the filing, and whether that is beneficial to the estate or prejudicial to the estate. And the bankruptcy court is best suited to do that. And there are parties in interest, such as the trustee's office and the creditors committee, who have a vested interest in determining that the proposed future claimants rep is the right person for the job. It's our view.
Would you say the qualities that were outlined in Fairbanks, perhaps without calling it guardian ad litem, are the qualities that the court should look for?
Yes, Your Honor. We would agree with that.
But we don't need the name.
I think that's correct. And if I may, just to follow up on the notion of the extent to which the court should consider the pre-petition involvement, that goes to the issue of appellate standing. So perhaps in the prepack context, which is not what we have here, but if there was a fully baked plan that was in front of the court, which precluded parties from weighing in on the appropriate of one issue or another, including a futures rep, precluded the parties from proposing additional candidates. And in fact, in this case, the judge left open the opportunity and noted that she would welcome additional candidates. If that were the case, maybe additional scrutiny in the form of broader appellate standing would be warranted, but not here. Departing from the prudential requirements of a party aggrieved provides insurers an opportunity to engage in great mischief in all of these cases. A benefit of a prepack case is you're preserving the value of the entity, theoretically. And by so doing, you're maximizing the value of the assets available for future claimants and other creditors. The interests of the parties with a financial stake in the outcome of the proceeding, the creditors and the company, are aligned in an efficient and quick case. The insurer's issues are diametrically opposed. Their interests are diametrically opposed to that. We all know the insurer's business model is to hold on to your reserves as long as you can and generate return. Insurers have capitalized on the standing ruling from Congolium to interject themselves into every portion of a mass tort case. And I think in the Congolium opinion itself, the court noted that allowing, given the myriad of parties and the myriad of interests, which are just exacerbated in a mass tort case, allowing every party who has an interest in the case, regardless of how tangential to the issue before the court, to participate in appeal and appeals is really contrary to the notion of judicial efficiency and economy.
Your friend, Mr. Martinez, said that forfeiture is the cleanest way to go here. I posited to your friend across the aisle that the involvement of both Bob Melveny and Young Conaway in the Warren Pumps case was so extensive that perhaps you could say they made a conscious decision not to pursue disqualification in their first objection. Would you comment on that?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not privy to O'Melveny's thinking, but I think the record in this case is fairly clear that Young Conaway does not have such a relationship with O'Melveny that they'd cut us a break in pursuing a conflict. Their behavior here shows exactly the opposite. They're pursuing a conflict for strategic reasons. They're really unrelated to any issue in the case. But
you might say they didn't pursue it initially for strategic reasons. I mean, I don't know.
One could speculate, and I don't know why they did or didn't do it. But we understood, you know, that is why for firms like ours who are routinely involved in bankruptcies, we rely on prospective waivers. This was a very specific waiver negotiated between sophisticated parties, both of whom are routinely involved in these kind of cases. So, you know, why O'Melveny did what it did, I can't say. It was our expectation, based on the waiver, which not only included a waiver, but a covenant not to raise this issue, that we would never hear from them.
Now, Mr. Martinez also said it's not the consent of the future claimants that is lacking here that should be determinative of waiver, because, you know, both parties usually, but the bankruptcy court. But has any court examined the waiver issue and looked at the predicament of having a waiver where you have unknown parties whose interests are basically being waived?
We certainly haven't identified any opinion on that issue in the 524G context.
Yeah, I'm sure you would have put it forth if you had.
We would.
But are these waivers upheld routinely in cases that like
this? Yes, Your Honor. I believe that Judge Silverstein noted that these waivers are commonplace in insolvency proceedings. And in fact, if the court were...
But with FCR, with future claimants is the key.
This is the, so Young Conway, we negotiate these waivers with all of our commercial clients. And we're particularly subsequent to this unfortunate predicament. We shy away from insurance work in general. But I'm not aware of this type of waiver having even been put at issue in another 524G case. But I'd like to make crystal clear to the court that the conflict here, to the extent it exists at all, is purely technical. The coverage work in Viking Pumps has concluded. There is no coverage work in the Emmers case. We were one of many local councils, which is common practice in Delaware. We had very nominal fees, and there's no dispute in the record that none of the attorneys at Young Conway who were involved in the Emmers representation, including Mr. Patton, ever had any role in the Viking Pumps dispute. And just a follow-up note on the waiver. Were this court to disregard the waiver, it would have several unfortunate consequences. As I say, it's commonplace in bankruptcy to utilize such a waiver, given the myriad of parties and issues who are involved in every case. And in essence, if the court were to determine to not give any weight to the waiver, you would be creating a category rule, which said that large firms who have ever represented insurers, or in fact ever represented creditors in matters, and insurers and creditors who are parties in a bankruptcy case, but the representation was in an unrelated matter, lawyers from those firms would be categorically disqualified from acting as FCRs. We think that would be to the disadvantage of future claimants. One of the factors that Judge Silverstein noted was the importance of experience.
Well, it wouldn't be categorical disqualification. It's just you don't credit the waiver. You look to whether there really is an actual conflict.
I agree, Your Honor.
But you're saying there might be an actual conflict, and yet it's waived. I get that.
I'm saying that if you did both, ignored the waiver, and then ignored the facts of, and then found a conflict back based on the facts of this case, where the conflict is technical at best, that would in essence be a per se rule.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. I know
we've all spoken a lot already. I appreciate the additional time. Just a few points. First, the idea that this is a technical and irrelevant conflict, I think, is just incorrect. I don't disagree with Mr. Martinez, my friend Mr. Martinez, that you should think about what a future claimant would think if he knew that somebody who was supposed to have undivided loyalty to them at the same time was supposed to have undivided loyalty to somebody else. I think they would probably be displeased by that, especially when this is an unrelated case. The arguments that they were making, that Young Conway was making in that case, and the clients that they were representing were making in that case, are directly adverse to the future claimants in this case, because those in that case who want to minimize insurance coverage, in this case, they want to maximize insurance coverage.
But don't you think a future claimant would say, well, okay, what did you do for them?
No.
Especially with Mr. Patton's credentials, he's done this before, he's very qualified to upset the apple cart and look for somebody else. You know, well, let us know exactly what you did for them, and then we'll decide whether we have a real problem.
Your Honor, I don't think so. That's precisely why actual conflicts don't require anything like that. If you have an actual conflict, you're disqualified absent a waiver from both sides. So my friend says that would disqualify everybody. It wouldn't disqualify everybody that does insurance work. It would only disqualify somebody who is currently representing clients that are adverse to the future claimants. Now, on the question of the standard, so it seems to me very strange. We have an automatic disqualification standard under Rule 327A, waivers don't apply. And that applies to people like accountants that are hired by the trustee. What sense would it make to have a rule that would automatically disqualify an accountant or a lawyer that works for the trustee, regardless of a waiver, but that same rule or a more stringent rule wouldn't apply to an FCR who's actually binding absent class members? That seems to me to make no sense at all. Now, the disinterested person standard, just really quickly on that one, that's not a standard. That's not like a default standard in the code. That's a definition. And Congress defined the term disinterested person, and Congress uses that term throughout the code in 332A, 333A2A, and the like. And when Congress uses the term disinterested or disinterested person, the definition applies. But Congress didn't use that in 524G, and it would be very strange, again, to use a lower standard to the extent that standard is lower than what would apply to lawyers for the trustee and the like or accountants.
But let's step back for a second to whether there is an actual conflict, because
sure,
when we consider whether there is a substantial similarity or cases are substantially related for purposes of the actual conflict, we're looking as whether it is actually the same issue or whether there's that substantial risk of confidential information being shared. In terms of it being the same issue, Your colleague has said that the coverage issues were resolved well before the appointment. So are we really dealing with the same issue?
No, that's certainly not true. Let me just highlight one issue in particular. One issue that was an issue at Warren Pumps was that the actual insured was somebody that was not Warren Pumps. And there's an anti-assignment clause in the insurance policies, and the question was whether the assignment to Warren Pumps of the policies was effective, and the court said they were. Young Conway argued that they were, you know, my clients that Young Conway represented argued that they weren't, and the insurers lost that argument in Warren Pumps. The same thing is happening here. Imerys is not the insured under these policies. Cypress is, and the argument is that Cypress assigned the policies to Imerys, and we have exactly the same argument that those assignments should not work. And now they're on the other side of that argument.
Where is that in the record? Where is that in the briefing? Well, where is any description of that before us? There's no word assignment of claims in the same issue.
It's in Mr. Month's declaration. He says more than one corporate entity asserts a claim to insurance policy proceeds.
Well, that happens all the time. The fact that more than one corporate entity asserts a claim
to the same insurance policies? I don't think that happens all the time. It seems to me that that's a pretty rare occurrence, and it occurred in both these cases. But I would just say that if you don't, so we think the prospective waiver doesn't apply because they're substantially related, the cases are substantially related. But let's say you disagree with that. Our argument is that there is a legal rule under 327A, and our argument that there is a similar legal rule that would apply to an FCR that renders that kind of waiver ineffective when you're talking about an FCR. And it seems to me that their argument relies on the proposition that Mr. Patton needs to be the FCR. There are plenty of other people that could be the FCR. All the district court, the bankruptcy court has to do at the outset is figure out whether there is a conflict. They say you should just leave it to the court. But why would you leave it to the court in the case of an FCR who's binding future claimants and not in the case of an accountant or a lawyer under 327A? It seems to me if a district court, certified a class, again, as I said, where the named plaintiff is adverse to the...
Under 327, you're still leaving it to the court to assure that the person's disinterested. So it's
and unconflicted, Your Honor. And this court has held that waivers don't solve a conflict. So if there's an actual conflict, as there is in this case, there would be an automatic disqualification. So that brings me to the point of standing. They say that there's no standing here because we waived our side of the conflict. And I'm not sure I understand what that means. Our standing is because two of our clients are being essentially sued by their own lawyer. It is our own injury. They have a merits argument that the waiver waived that conflict, but there's no such thing as waiving a side of the conflict. Either the waiver is effective or it isn't. It's not effective because under 1.7 you need a bilateral waiver, and it's not effective because under 327A no waiver counts, and we don't understand why a legal standard that's less stringent would apply to an FCR than it would to, again, you know, any professional that's hired by a trustee. And the last point on forfeiture, I can't imagine what strategic reason there would be for us not to object to Mr. Patton. We already objected to Mr. Patton, just not on this ground because we didn't know about this ground. I know, Your Honor, you don't believe us. I'm just saying we didn't know about this ground, and it was in the discretion of the bankruptcy. The only question here is whether we timely filed the objection under the bankruptcy court's own internal rules. Mr. Martinez cites a Supreme Court case. Of course, the Supreme Court has certiorari jurisdiction, and they can decide whatever issue they want. I don't know what the Second Circuit case or the Eighth Circuit case held, but I would be very, very surprised if the issue there was that the lower court's own internal schedule was altered by the court itself, not some claims processing rule in a statute, not under the bankruptcy rules or under the rules of civil procedure, but the bankruptcy court's own decision to extend its own deadline based, as the bankruptcy court said it was, on a supplemental declaration would result in a waiver or a forfeiture. That seems totally implausible to me. Thank you very much.
Counsel, one final question.
Sure.
With Mr. Schiavone's involvement, both in Warren Pumps and in this case, why isn't his knowledge to be imputed to you and your clients?
Because I think it's totally reasonable to rely on disclosures, right? The disclosure, again, talked about in cases about environmental liabilities. Warren Pumps isn't one. You know, there are a lot of cases going around, and, you know, I don't think that lawyers should be required to remember all the law firms that work on all of them. But again, even if you disagree with that, it seems to me that all we're talking about is whether the bankruptcy court's decision to extend its own case management deadline was an abuse of discretion. And I can't imagine why it would be, especially when the bankruptcy court said that the reason it was doing it is because of Mr. Patton's supplemental disclosures. So the bankruptcy court obviously thought that they were relevant, and I can't imagine how that could be an abuse of discretion.
And finally, do you take any position on whether the court should invite the input of the trustee as to the applicable standard?
Leave that up to the discretion of the court.
We thank counsel for excellent, excellent briefing and argument today. It's been very helpful to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We would ask that a transcript be prepared and that the parties split the cost. And we will take the case under advisement.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you all.